Lesson 6, Calvin's Doctrine of Providence. And you know the doctrine of providence in John Calvin. I've pretty much, through the years, as I've taught this course, I've noted how relevant this has been for me. So every time I come back to this particular topic, there's a little personal note in the margin of my institutes about what's going on in my life. It's almost like a little diary there. And the significance and importance of God's providence in our lives. So I was preaching about in chapel yesterday. In fact, back in 1989, when I was first diagnosed with lymphoma, I had to miss a class. I was teaching Calvin's Institutes, and I had to miss a class because of that. The topic was providence. So when I came back after having missed that class, I was able to pick up with this wonderful treatment of God's providence. Let's start with a prayer from John Calvin, as we do each day. And this prayer has a particular relevance to the subject at hand. Let's pray. Grant, Almighty God, that since we are here exposed to so many evils which suddenly arise like violent tempest, O grant that with hearts raised up to heaven, we may yet acquiesce in thy hidden providence, and be so tossed here and there, even though we are so tossed here and there, according to the judgment of our flesh, yet to remain fixed in this truth, that thou wouldst have us believe, that all things are governed by thee, and that nothing takes place except through thy will, so that in the greatest confusions we may always clearly see thy hand, and that thy counsel is altogether right, and perfectly and singularly wise and just. And may we ever call upon thee and flee to this port, that we are tossed here and there, in order that thou mayest nevertheless always sustain us by thine hand, until we shall at length be received into that blessed rest which has been procured for us by the blood of thine only begotten Son. Amen. I've been reading a book. It's called Sea Room, Island Life in the Hebrides. It's an account of a man who spends a lot of his time on three very tiny islands. Just a few acres each, out in the Minch. That's the water that separates the Isle of Skye from the island of Harris and Lewis. And interested in things Scottish, so going through this book about these little islands. But I came upon this this incident reported by the writer last night. This took place in 1894 on the island of Lewis. Lewis is probably the most Presbyterian part of Scotland. Stornoway, the little capital of Lewis, has about 12 churches. 10 of the 12 are Presbyterian churches. Now, this little storefront Catholic church and some other kind, an Anglican church. Tiny little beautiful Anglican church, but all the rest are Presbyterian. So a lot of Presbyterians on Lewis. And here's the story. Is there much fishing in this loch now? A Lewis crofter, or farmer, was asked by one of the investigating commissioners who came up from London in 1894. There used to be when herring came into it, he said. There's very little fishing except when there are herring. Do you know the reason why the herring are not coming now? Providence, the crofter said. The administration of the Creator. So the London investigator got a little lesson in theology there. But I want to keep that little story in mind because it illustrates a number of things that I want to talk about in relation to Calvin's doctrine of providence. Calvin follows the doctrine of creation with the doctrine of providence. These two are extremely important to him and important to be linked. He says, we see the presence of divine power shining as much in the continuing state of the universe as in its inception. And you'll notice that this Presbyterian crofter got it just right when he said providence, the administration of the Creator. Providence is the work of the Creator, the continuing government of the Creator, the one who created all things, now preserves and governs all things. Now, there's one book on Calvin's theology that says at this point in his systematics, in his institutes, he comes closer to the tone of ecstasy than he does anywhere else in the institutes. And that may well be. There are plenty of places where Calvin rises to celebration or ecstasy, but he certainly does that in his treatment here. For instance, this sentence in 116:1, God sustains, nourishes, and cares for everything he has made, even to the least sparrow. Now, that kind of sings, doesn't it? You can see Calvin rejoicing as he writes those words. Well, let's look at Calvin's definition of providence, and to do that, I'll go through a number of steps here. Calvin works on a definition, and I think we can organize it this way, beginning with this statement: it's more than foreknowledge, it's government. Providence is not simply God knowing beforehand what's going to happen. Calvin says, 116:4, God governs all events. Thus it pertains no less to his hands than to his eyes. That it's not just God's eyes. In fact, the word providence is really what it means. It means to see beforehand. But it's more than that. You might say providence is more than providence in Calvin's view. It's more than just seeing beforehand what's going to happen. That would be amazing enough, you know, if God could see all down through history and see everything that's going to happen all the way down to this very moment. But Calvin says it's not merely seeing what's going to happen, but it's governing what happens. So it pertains to his hands, that is, he is controlling all things, as well as seeing what lies ahead. He doesn't just see what's going to happen, he determines what's going to happen. Second point in definition, more than permission, it's direction. Calvin deals here with the possibility of using the word permission. Is that acceptable? Can we say God permits some things and directs some things? Can we make that kind of distinction? You remember how Calvin treats that. He notes that Augustine, and he loves Augustine and generally follows Augustine, he says Augustine frequently uses the term permission. Augustine will say God permitted Adam and Eve to sin, or permitted the devil to do such and such. And actually Calvin will too, occasionally. He'll use the expression permission. But Calvin says that Augustine's term is best understood from this sentence in Augustine's Enchiridion. For it would not be done if he did not permit it. Yet he does not unwillingly permit it, but willingly. And that's the understanding of permission that Calvin picks up on. Yes, you can use permission. You can say God permits things to happen in this world, but he does not permit things unwillingly. He permits things willingly. In other words, use permission in a strong sense, not in a weak sense. Calvin doesn't like what he calls mere permission or bare permission or indolent permission. He uses those words to qualify permission, and he says if that's what we mean, then it's not true of God. You know, we can use permission in that weak sense. Your child wants to do something, and you don't want the child to do it. You don't think it's good, but children have a way of pestering you, and they keep on at it until finally sometimes the parent will say, oh, go ahead and do it. You know, that's permission, but that's not willing permission. That's giving in. That's mere permission or weak permission or indolent permission. So Calvin says, no, God doesn't really do that. God doesn't just throw up his hands and say, oh, go ahead and do it, because he gets tired of hearing about it. The term permission, then, can be used, but it's more than that. God's providence is more than that. The term permission doesn't really absolve God from responsibility for what happens. You can't say, well, I'll use permission here so God isn't so involved in what happened. But that weak use of the word weakens God's authority, and it does not absolve God from responsibility. I think in Calvin's treatment, good and evil are not related ultimately to the will of God in exactly the same way, as we'll see. But the word permission, the concept of permission, is not accurate or not helpful, Calvin says. You can use it, but use it in the right way. As Calvin does in 1:14:17, where he says, Satan carries out only those things which have been divinely permitted to him. So there Calvin will use permission, but in the strong sense, not in the weak sense. All right, third point, it's more than general, it is particular. Here Calvin is dealing with the philosophers who teach a kind of universal providence. If Calvin lived later, he would include the deist in his critique here. Calvin is not a deist. The deist believed in a universal providence. That is, God in some general way is superintending, but he's not really involved in the small points of human history or the history of this world. The deists believe that God created the universe, put laws into effect, and then kind of turned his back on it, sometimes called the watchmaker view. Make the watch, wind it up, and ignore it. But that's not Calvin's view of providence. It's more than general. It is particular. John T. McNeil, the editor of our edition of the Institutes, and a book that he wrote called The History and Character of Calvinism, which is still a very useful book for Calvinistic history, has this sentence, Calvin's world, from stars to insects, from archangels to infants, is the realm of God's sovereignty. So you see how particular it gets. Not only the big things, but the small things. And I think as we read the chapters that we studied for today, we get that illustrated very clearly. 1:16:5, not one drop of rain falls without his sure command. See how particular that is. Or think about the snow a couple days ago. Every little snowflake coming down, how many came down? Well, who knows? But every one was coming down at God's particular command. And 1:16:5, the flight of birds is governed by God's definite plan. you stand outside at night and watch the birds when they are all over the sky, I mean, nothing looks more chaotic and unplanned than these birds swirling all over the place. But according to Calvin, the flight of the birds is planned by God. 116:7, no wind ever arises or increases except by God's express command. So, nothing is too small, you might say, to be outside of God's providence, outside of God's government. Think. One way to illustrate what I've said so far is to think of the African-American spiritual. He's got the whole wide world in his hands. And the spiritual goes on, you know, to say he's got the tiny little baby in his hands. And that brings us to the next point. It's more than nature. You might say up at till this point, Calvin has said God controls nature, but he hasn't said anything yet about mankind. But it's more than nature. He also governs mankind. And even, according to Calvin, the plans and intentions of men. 116:8. He governs everything that people do, not only their actions, but also their plans and their intentions. And Calvin says, even the sinful actions and intentions of people. So spiritual gets it right, doesn't it? Not only does he have the tiny little baby in his hands, but he's got the sinner man in his hands. That spiritual is a wonderful statement of Calvin's view of God's providence. So Calvin relentlessly and even, you might say, enthusiastically just keeps right on going until he has included everything and excluded nothing from his view of providence or the government of God. Now, he's well aware that this raises some questions in people's minds, but he wants to first of all be absolutely sure that we know what he's talking about. One of the questions that it raises is, well, this sounds like fate. This sounds like fate. And the next point is not fate, providence. How does Calvin deal with this objection? It sounds like fate. If everything is fixed, if everything is determined, if God knows and plans and governs everything that happens, is that not fatalistic? Well, Calvin says no. It's interesting how he deals with this. He says, fate is a pagan term. It's not a Christian term. It's a pagan term. Providence is a biblical concept. Beside that, fate is impersonal. The Stoic doctrine of fate presupposed that all events were governed by the necessity of nature, which contained within itself an intimately related series of causes and effects. It's impersonal. It's a machine cranking out whatever it's cranking out. There's no person there behind it all. So quite a difference between fate and Calvin's view of providence, because providence is personal. It is the Christian doctrine of a holy and loving God and his personal governance of this universe. So if somebody would say to Calvin, but your view is fate, he says, no, it's not fate. It's not a Christian word. It's a pagan term. And beside that, fate means an impersonal ordering, a mindless ordering of what happens. I'm talking about the government of all things by a good, holy, just, and righteous God. So, let's sum it all up. You don't find this precisely stated anywhere in the Institutes like I've quoted it here or stated it here in the outline, but putting all Calvin's thoughts together, we get something like this. God's providence is his watchful, effective, active, ceaseless, total, detailed, personal, loving, wise, and holy governing of this world. Okay, that's the definition. Next, let's come to the application of this definition. And ask the question, as Calvin does, how does God's providence work? We know what it is now, but we want to look at it more closely and see how it works. And Calvin says, 117:1, sometimes through an intermediary, sometimes without an intermediary, sometimes contrary to every intermediary. So providence can work in different ways. I'll try to illustrate this to get at what Calvin is saying. Sometimes God's providence works through an intermediary. I was talking earlier about my medical situation, and I think God's providence has worked in my life to keep me alive to this point through intermediaries. I go to the hospital hundreds of times. I've taken all kinds of medicines. I've had all kinds of radiation surgeries, things like that. So God's purpose is to keep me alive up until this point, and who knows how long, that's in God's hands, but it's been through intermediaries. God works often that way. Second causes. He'll use that expression too. Sometimes without an intermediary. I think it's entirely possible for God to heal someone who cannot go to the doctors or does not have access to medicine. God can heal directly if he so chooses. And in that case, the work of God is without an intermediary. And sometimes contrary to every intermediary. It seems to me here we've got something like the raising of Lazarus from the dead. You see, the intermediaries or the second causes were operative there. Whatever it was that caused Lazarus to die, that was an intermediary that produced the death of this man. And then he is dead, and yet Christ comes and raises him from the dead, contrary to those intermediaries. Whatever killed Lazarus and the scientific facts that were operative in his death, those facts would have worked to keep Lazarus dead, but contrary to those facts, Christ works to bring him back to life. Seems to me that this third possibility, sometimes contrary to every intermediary, is what we would call a miracle. Now, I suppose some people would call my point two a miracle. God heals someone without medical assistance, and if you want to call that miracle, it's fine with me. But point three is definitely a miracle in the full biblical sense of the word, that Christ raises a person from the dead. Or Jesus walks on the water. You see, the intermediary there is gravity. But in this case, God works contrary to the intermediary. So the intermediary doesn't work here in this miracle. Well, I won't get into the question because Calvin doesn't hear whether this kind of thing still happens. You can ask Dr. Williams or Dr. Peterson about that. Actually, Calvin does in the dedicatory letter to Francis I, you might remember, if you read that letter, one of the objections that Calvin says is raised to the Protestant truth is, you don't have any miracles. The Catholics have miracles, and you don't have any miracles, so your religion can't be true. And Calvin says, oh yes, we have miracles. We have plenty of miracles. Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. Jesus walked on the water. And he goes through the whole catalog of biblical miracles. So at that point, he seems to restrict his understanding of miracles to what happened in Bible times, not later miracles. But getting back to how God's providence works, sometimes through an intermediary, sometimes without an intermediary, sometimes contrary to an intermediary. But once he has established that, Calvin wants to be sure that we understand that even when God works through an intermediary, it's still God who works. In other words, God works through second causes, and we acknowledge those second causes. But we don't say then, it's not God who has worked. Calvin's illustration here is that light existed before the sun was created. You know, in the Genesis account, light is before the sun. And Calvin's point is the sun is merely the instrument that God uses because he so wills. Now, the light comes from God, but then God chose to use the sun as the source of the light for our world, and yet it's still coming from God. The light comes from God, but the light comes from the sun. But because we say the light comes from the sun, we're not to say the light does not come from God. So Calvin applies it that way. He applies it to our eating food. He says, it's not the bread that nourishes, but God's secret blessing. Now, he doesn't mean that the bread doesn't nourish. We eat the food, and we are nourished and fed by the food and strengthened by the food. But Calvin doesn't want to stop there. He wants to say it's God's secret blessing enabling us to eat that food and be nourished by it. So, for Calvin, second causes are real, but not independent. They don't exist apart from the personal involvement of God. It is chance, not second causes, that Calvin banishes from the universe with his view of providence. What does God's providence do? Well, it does. It does everything, doesn't it? If it is total, complete, particular, then there's nothing that it doesn't do. But Calvin wants to stress that all of this that God is doing in this world reveals his concern for the whole human race, but especially his vigilance in ruling the church, 117:1. It's rather interesting and impressive to think about that, which really means that everything that happens in this world is for the benefit of the human race, or it reflects God's concern for the human race. I mean, I'm going to say in a minute, we can't really see that. We can't always understand that. In fact, we very seldom can understand that. But Calvin says, not only is it done for the whole human race, but especially for the church. It's astounding when you think about it, that everything is working together for good for the church. We can use the text that way. Everything is working together for the good of God's church. Well, he states that, how much can we understand? Not very much. The order, reason, end, and necessity of those things which happen, for the most part, lie hidden in God's purpose and are not apprehended by human opinion. It's 116:9. 117:1, he does say, God's fatherly favor and beneficence or severity of judgment often shine forth in the whole course of providence. Nevertheless, sometimes the causes of events are hidden. I think putting those two together, you get something like this. Providence is not totally mysterious. As a Christian looks at the world, we're not just totally baffled. God's purpose, his judgment, his blessing, shines forth in its broader outline. So in the whole flow of history, we can say, we can see God's judgment at work. We can see God blessing and preserving the church. We can see him judging sin. But just in the big picture, you know, we get down to the particulars and what God is doing then is obscure or hidden from us. We can't just look at some event in history and always be sure we know what that means. Always be sure we know what God is doing there. So we must cherish moderation that we do not try to make God render account to us. When we come up against our limited understanding, Calvin says, we must be moderate. We must not demand that God tell us what he has not chosen to tell us, and we must reverently adore. So once again, we come to worship. So many times we'll reach this point in the institutes when our understanding fails. We don't, in frustration, just hammer on the door of heaven and demand that God reveal to us what he is doing, but we fall on our knees in worship. So how do you look at providence? You look at it as God's doing everything that is done in different ways, using sometimes second causes, sometimes working without them, doing it all for the benefit of humanity and especially for the good of the church. But it's a matter of faith, not understanding. Some understanding, but not total understanding. It's a Puritan, John Flavel. He wrote a book on providence in which he said that providence is like a Hebrew word. It can only be read backwards. So you can look back and see what God is doing or has done. But I think Flavel may overstate it a bit, as the Puritans often tend to. Providence is more like some Hebrew words that I look at. It can't be read at all, at least not by me. Not a good illustration for Dr. Collins or Dr. Anschultz or some of our Hebrew scholars, but I'm puzzled. I don't know what it means. And as we look back at history as a historian, often it's impossible to say exactly what was happening there. So God's providence is often mystery. And even though we can see in the broader outlines the general scope of what God is doing. I mean, we know that God is judging sin, but he doesn't judge it completely in this life. That teaches us that there is a judgment to come. And God blesses the righteous, but sometimes in this life, the righteous don't appear to be blessed, which teaches us that there is a heaven to come. So even the limitations that we have in understanding God's providence are positive lessons to point us to the future. What is the effect of the doctrine of God's providence in our lives? First, let me say this, that it doesn't lead us into an easy, superficial optimism. It doesn't enable us to say, well, everything's working out, God is in control, and kind of a casual view of things. God's in his heaven, all's right with the world view, to quote Browning. But all's not right with the world, and we know that. We see awful things, and we're disturbed, and we are concerned. So as Christians, we don't have a easy, superficial optimism. Not even as Calvinists do we have a easy, superficial optimism. We have a Christian optimism, but that's quite a different thing from just a kind of a Pollyanna view. Suppose at one time in history, maybe, people could have had a Pollyanna view. It's kind of hard right now to adopt that kind of view, but perhaps some people still do. Secondly, it doesn't relieve us of responsibility or prudence. You can't say, well, since what God is doing is going to be done anyway, then it doesn't matter what I do. We're not excused from due prudence, since human precaution itself is one of the means that God uses to preserve life. In other words, God tends to preserve our lives. One of the ways that he does that is to use our common sense, our prudence. We go to the doctor when we're sick. We drive carefully when it's icy highway, and so on. We don't say, well, God's in control, so I'll just get in my car and speed along the highway at top speed when I know that I could hit some ice and crash my car. We can't do that. We have to exercise the prudence and the precaution that God would have us do. Calvin says in 117:4, therefore, if the Lord has committed to us the protection of our life, our duty is to protect it. If he offers helps, to use them. If he forewarns us of dangers, not to plunge headlong. If he makes remedies available, not to neglect them. So be smart, be prudent, be responsible. But believe in the doctrine of God's providence too. You see, providence is our comfort in life. It's not our guide. It's our comfort. It's not our guide. Our guide is God's law. God requires of us only what he commands, Calvin says in 117:5. So you do what you believe God is instructing you to do through his word, and then you take comfort in the fact that God is in control of all things. You see that sheet in the syllabus called Exercise in Providence. Turn over a couple of pages. If we had time, I would have you do that right now, but since this is going to be a bit of a short class, I won't. But do this sometime, perhaps today, when you're still thinking about it. That first section, things that have worked out well for me, just write down things that have worked out well. And then the second, adversities I'm experiencing. Put down some of those. All of us have something. And then things I'm worried about. So take a few minutes, not now, but later, and do that. And I'll tell you what to do with it. Calvin says that providence leads us to gratitude of mind for the favorable outcome of things. So in that first section, when you've written down those things that have worked out well for you, then stop and spend a few minutes in prayer to God, in thanksgiving to God, gratitude to God for those things. We can so easily take things like that for granted and not realize the goodness of God in doing so many wonderful things in our lives. So write gratitude in that first section and actually express your gratitude to God. Gratitude of mind for the favorable outcome of things. Patience in adversity. Look at your list of adversities after you've written those down and exercise patience. Calvin says that there are three rules for the Christian life. One is patience, two is patience, three is patience. So we need to be patient. And three, incredible freedom of worry about the future. Don't have time to read to you 1:17:10, but you read that section in which Calvin describes all the things that can go wrong. Pretty horrendous listing. You walk out of your house and a tile falls off the roof and kills you. So you flee into the garden, or if the tile misses you, you flee into the garden and there a deadly serpent attacks you. I mean, all these problems, and think of how many more Calvin could have added if he lived in the 21st century. It's a good thing Calvin was a Calvinist, because he had plenty to worry about even back in his time. And his picture of the fragility of the human condition is impressive. And as I say, we can add to all that too. So there's plenty to worry about. But when you get your list there of things to worry about, just take your pen, or better, a big, thick magic marker, and put a big X across it all. Incredible freedom of worry about the future. And if you believe in God's providence, what are you worrying about? So those are important points to help us understand the effect of the doctrine of God's providence in our lives. But we need to come now to the problem of providence, because having said all this, we still have some big problems, or a big problem to deal with. Calvin insists that everything is directed by God, but that raises a real problem, because a person will say, well, what about sin? What about evil? Is God directing that? Is he planning that? Is he governing that? The last chapter of Book 1, before we get to Book 2, is Calvin's answer. God carries out his will, while at the same time he remains pure from every stain. So two points that must be held together. One is this. Yes, God directs and governs everything. Calvin says it this way. Nothing is done without God's will, not even that which is against his will. 1:18:3. Nothing is done without God's will, not even that which is against his will. But the other statement that must be held is this. God is not the author of sin, and mankind is responsible. Well, how can it be that if God directs and governs everything, he's not the author of sin? Because sin would be part of everything. Well, Calvin's answer here is an interesting one, and it's basically this. God is not the author of sin because he says he's not the author of sin. Calvin says there's clear scriptural proofs, and he goes through those proofs. We know that God uses evil without being the author, the singular, of evil. We know that God uses evil without being the author of evil. God knows, Calvin says, right well how to use evil instruments to do good. God can use evil without being the author of evil, because God's purpose in using evil is to do good. Luther put it more colorfully. He said God can use a crooked stick to draw a straight line. So God uses evil instruments to do good. We know that. Plenty of references in the Bible that God is doing that. But secondly, we don't know how God uses evil without being the author of evil. We don't really understand how God wills to take place what he forbids to be done. Calvin's major illustration here is the death of Christ. God forbids murder. That's what the death of Christ was. God forbids that. It's not his will. It's against his will. But the death of Christ was the will of God. He planned it. Part of his purpose. So he wills to take place what he forbids to be done. He's not guilty of sin. He's not the author of sin. The sin rests upon Herod and upon Pilate and upon us. But still God plans the death of Christ, while at the same time forbidding murder. God is omnipotent. That means he directs everything. And God is good. That means that he forbids sin. God is omnipotent. He directs everything. He's good. He forbids sin. How do we put those two things together? This is where we come out in the Institutes. Does God then have two wills? Calvin talks about God's preceptive will and his decretive will. His decretive will would be that Christ would die on the cross. His perceptive will is that you shall not kill, shall not murder. So does that mean that God has two wills? Calvin says no, there is a single, simple will. So behind the two wills. What looks like two wills to us, decretive and preceptive, there is a single will. Even though we can't plumb the depths of that will, it is deep, another hidden will, which we cannot fathom. John Murray doesn't particularly like that language and thinks that we should not think of a single will because the language is, to him, a problem. But I don't really see that it's a problem if we understand what Calvin is saying. What looks like two wills is really one will. But what do we have there? Do we have contradiction? Do we have mystery? Calvin says in 117.5, God's will is so great and boundless. He's so great and boundless in his wisdom that he knows right well how to use evil instruments to do good. It would almost sound like a contradiction. But 118.3, when we do not grasp how God wills to take place what he forbids to be done, let us recall our mental incapacity and at the same time consider that the light in which God dwells is not without reason called unapproachable. So he brings us right up, I would say, to the point of mystery and doesn't really answer the question. He says, when you come up to this point, there are two things to remember. One is our mental incapacity. We're not able to deal with this. And secondly, the fact that God dwells in light, which is unapproachable. So it seems to me that what Calvin is telling us here is we believe God is omnipotent. He directs everything. We believe God is good. He forbids sin. And the way we're able to believe both of those is not because we understand how it can be, but we believe both of those by faith. Now, is that a cop-out or is that a good thing? Some people might think it's a cop-out, but what do you put in its place? Can you really understand how God can be good and omnipotent at the same time? A lot of people have just forsaken one or the other of those points. If God is good, he can't be omnipotent. If God is omnipotent, he can't be good. But if God is both good and omnipotent, and we believe both to be taught in the Bible, then the way we hold together what seems to be a contradiction or at least a mystery is to believe that both are true, even though we can't understand. Okay, that's God's, or Calvin's, I hope it's God's too, doctrine of providence. We come next to sin and its results, the first five chapters of book two.